WPFW.org.
The talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcasts, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Peace, y'all. This is Rod Stars.
This is G1. Together, we Rebel Diaz.
And when we out here in D.C., the DMV, we bump WPFW.
Washington.
Every Tuesday, 9 to 10 a.m., Voices with Vision. You heard?
Understand. We've been trying to move this struggle from a lower to a higher level.
This is Voices with Vision, bringing you news and analysis.
It's about cutting-edge social justice issues by mixing various voices and ideas
with information, cultural expressions, and commentary.
Voices with Vision airs every Tuesday on your Jazz and Justice station, WPFW.
Good morning, sisters and brothers, comrades and friends. Welcome to the May 7th, 2024 edition of Voices with Vision, the show not for the politically faint of heart. In case you don't know, we are unapologetically radical. No compromise, no retreat. I'm Nefer Freeman in the virtual studio with co-host Brother Craig. What's up, good brother?
Hey, good morning, Nefer. It's looking like 2024 is a new 1968. We got a brutal genocidal war with the U.S. involved up to its knees, student unrest being met with police repression, a looming Democratic National Convention in Chicago, no less, that promises to be a battleground between bankrupt political elites and the increasingly awakened and enraged public they pretend to represent. What else? Crime bills and law and order politics and African and South American nations rising up against neocolonial masters. There's no better time than now to get politically educated, organized, and moving forward together to strike a blow for freedom.
And speaking of what's going on in the world, the role of students as the spark of the revolution, we have some remarks by Dr. Roy Benjamin addressing students at Spelman College and encouraging them to transform the world and not be conscripted into positions of power that maintain the oppressive status quo.
We're also going to rebroadcast a segment from the Critical Hour with Garland Nixon on Radio Sputnik, where he's talking to Netfa and Dr. Linwood Tawid about the student protest in support of Palestinian freedom and the rejection of U.S. and French imperialism by the Alliance of Sahel States and continued U.S. colonization of Haiti.
And we'll be giving you a reading of a recent article entitled "Washington Has Lost Touch with Reality. If it doesn't adapt, the world will pay." The article looks into the mind of the U.S. intelligence network as it deals with a world resisting U.S. hegemony. We'll kick off today's program with audio of Mumia Abu-Jamal addressing City University of New York students at a Free Palestine encampment. For all our freedom fighters, the U.S. held political prisoners languishing behind prison walls. What's the call?
Free them all.
massive frustration. But what we're involved in right now, I think, is something called mass education. And City College and Columbia and Emory and USC are all part of that process right now. That education is about the repression that Gaza is suffering under. It is a wonderful thing that you have decided not to be silent and decided to speak out against the repression that you see with your own eyes. So you are part of something massive, and you are part of something that is on the right side of history. You're against a colonial regime that wants to steal the land from the people who are indigenous to that area. And you say that that is wrong. I urge you to speak out against the terrorism that is afflicting Gaza with all of your might, all of your will, and all of your strength. Do not bow to those who want you to be silent. It is time, right now, this day, this hour, this moment, to be heard and shake the earth so that the people of Gaza, the people of Rafah, the people of the West Bank, the people of Palestine can feel your solidarity with them. I am a student of the late, great Frantz Fanon, and I read him every day and think about his ideas. And when I see what is happening in Gaza right now, I know that right now, the people of Gaza are the wretched of the earth, and they are fighting to be free from generations of occupation. So it is not enough, brothers and sisters in suit and acknowledge, it is not enough to demand ceasefire. How about this? Make your demand. Cease occupation. Cease occupation. Cease occupation.
Occupation!
Let that be your battle cry, because that is the call of history, of which all of you are a part. You're part of something magnanimous, magnificent, and soul-changing, mind-changing, history-changing. Do not let go of this moment. Make it bigger. Make it more massive. Make it more powerful. Make it echo up into the stars. I am thrilled by your work. I love you. I admire you. On the move.
On the move!
Billions of people all around the world. You folks, think about this. Think about what happened when a brother named George Floyd was being asphyxiated with a knee on his neck just a few years ago. It sparked an international movement that hasn't been seen in generations. What you're seeing now on your phones, right? Not on your TVs, but on your phones, is a kind of unseen repression against an essentially powerless team. The people who've been behind the walls of Palestine for generations, who suffered 75 years of occupation, who do not have the freedom to turn on their water or to repel air attacks by F-18s. You see, so when you see that kind of oppression, it magnifies what is happening and it moves you. Because if you don't have a heart, you know, you wouldn't be moved. But you have a heart, you're looking at that, it is moving you, it's moving your soul. So that's what connects us, right, as human beings. Oppression, oppression. The Quran says what? Oppression is worse than death, because oppression destroys the soul, the spirit, the hope of being human. So keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Do you guys, we have a little more time. Does anyone have a question? What do you want to do after you get out?
I'm going to walk on my street in France.
Beautiful.
So I wanted to ask, looking at this crisis of journalism, you as one of our most liberatory journalism experts and practitioners and revolutionaries, what do you have to say to the independent journalists of, you know, the University of the People's University of Palestine?
This is a moment for independent journalists, because corporate journalism is falling short. You know, corporate journalism is kind of propaganda, right? It's the message for the powerful, right? It's not the message for the poor and the oppressed.
Hey, where are you?
You know, corporate journalism is selling soap. Independent journalists are speaking out because they're free to speak out. You know, if I were a corporate journalist, I couldn't say the thing that, well, if I did say what I was saying, I would be fired in a heartbeat, you know. And that happened in the old days. I got fired, like, from every station I ever worked at. Because I refused to shut up and not, you know, say the thing they didn't want me to say.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We love you!
Thank you!
We love you!
We love you!
What do you say to those who framed you?
You have to frame me, but you have to stop me.
What would you say? What would you say to the almost 10,000 Palestinian prisoners, Mumia?
That I am with you, that we are with you, and all Palestinian political prisoners should be free, but most importantly, Palestine must be free.
Places are not going to save us. Just look at the black proponents of Cop City in Atlanta's leadership class.
Dr. Ruhab Benjamin addressing Spelman College commencement ceremony.
Black faces in high places are not going to save us. Just look at the black woman's hand, ambassador at the UN, voting against a ceasefire in Gaza. That is, our blackness and our womanness are not in themselves trustworthy. If we allow ourselves to be conscripted into positions of power that maintain the oppressive status quo, Our blackness and womanness are not themselves trustworthy if we support the occupation of black neighborhoods with so-called better trained police, or remain silent about the genocide of oppressed peoples around the world funded by our tax dollars. And here, let me please shout out the incredible Spelman students and AUC siblings who have been organizing with Stop Cop City and Justice in Palestine, among many other troublemakers in this room. You all remind us that college is not a waiting room to enter the real world, but that you can start transforming that world right here, right now. It goes without saying, but let me just say it anyway. For student activists speaking out courageously for Palestine and Congo and Haiti and to stop Cop City, they should not be threatened with expulsion, loss of scholarships, or have public safety called on them for protesting. Too often, our institutions celebrate student activists after they've graduated. Even giving them honorary degrees. But stifle student activism while we are enrolled.
We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Garland Nixon. The African and Haitian people are working to end U.S. and European colonialism and imperialism, and the U.S. government's response to the campus protests helps us to understand the nature of the state. Joining us now to discuss this and more, we've got Netfa Freeman. He's the host of Voices with Vision on WPFW 89.3. FM here in Washington, D.C. He's a Pan-Africanist and international organizer. Netfa, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you. Thank you, Garland.
We also have Dr. Linwood Tawheed. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. Dr. Tawheed, thank you very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
You know, I'm going to start with this big story because this is the story that's, I think is at the top of the list. We got a lot to talk about, but we got to touch on this. Margaret Kimberly's got a great article. I think it's powerful. Repression of Campus Palestine Solidarity Reveals the Nature of the State. Campus protests in solidarity with Palestine have been met with brute police force and condemnation of the participants. Their mobilization is a threat to the political system, which cannot operate as the ruling class would like if large numbers of people engage in active dissent. Very interesting that the kids are out and they're protesting and the system is going haywire. Red lights are flashing everywhere on K Street. Let's start with your thoughts. Netfa Freeman.
Yeah, the United States is just really in an insane mode right now, is grasping for its legitimacy. Israel as an extension of U.S. imperialism or just Western imperialism in general has been, has so obscenely and obviously, its existence represents settler colonialism, represents occupation of the Palestinian people. It's hard to keep a lid on it, and the fact that the U.S. is wholly committed to a genocidal act also helps to decrease their hegemony around the world, because everybody in the world is watching, and these young people and their repression against the young people who are clearly on the right side of history, who are standing up against the genocide, they're so desperate and what not being able to contain these things, they're willing to unleash the repression that we're seeing. Maybe people could argue that the degree of it does not comparable to anything like the Palestinians are facing or anything else. But the fact that they're willing to do it, and that there's no negotiation, these young people who are doing nothing but standing up for what's right when they unleash this repression when you go to the encampments, which I've been here at least to the Washington, D.C. one. And when you go to them, you know, these are young people. They're doing teach-ins. They're having, you know, different little classes. The activities that they're doing are really not any type of don't pose any harm to anyone. And we see the corporate media spinning it, always trying to put a microphone in some young person who's maybe unclear or has committed to Zionism themselves, identifying as a Jewish person, saying, I feel unsafe, you know, and then they'll have two or three, you know, couple of people there because they're trying to keep the, while you're seeing a whole encampment of people. And now they can't even get around the fact that there are a lot of Jewish people who are standing, you know, who are part of the encampments, who are standing against the genocide, and that they, you know, they want to avoid interviewing them. But then, you know, I just saw a young lady the few days ago on the news, and who was part of the encampment, had a kufi wrapped around her, saying, I feel safer here than I do outside the encampment. Because, you know, and so they're trying to keep a lid on this narrative. But I, you know, the truth and the material reality of things always comes to light. And as Margaret's, you know, piece demonstrates, that it reveals the true nature of these existential threat to the humanity of the collective West.
Dr. Taheed, another interesting dynamic is Columbia University, Yale. In Columbia, this is where the ruling elite trains their next, you know, their next staff. They train the people to take their place, you know, and they expect these people to come out and follow the company line. And to see them use violence and brutality against their own progeny, for goodness sake, it's very interesting. But your thoughts on Margaret's discussion on what we and the students learn from the reaction of the ruling elite, the reaction of the government on this, which seems just, you know, violent and overblown.
Well, these students are in fact doing what we have trained them to do, what we've taught them to do. We've taught them that this is democracy, that we've taught them that justice shall prevail. We've taught them that they are to speak up when things aren't right, and they're doing exactly what they were taught to do, and now they're finding out that, well, their parents didn't really mean that. Or let me not say parents. The ruling parents did not really mean that, because, you know, some of these students' parents are in fact supporters of their own children. And so these students are getting the lesson that perhaps what they were taught in elementary school, middle school, high school is not exactly how the world works. And it is a good revelation for them to learn this at this time. But one thing they also know as young people is that eventually the old people will be dead. And so they are standing up. They are doing what they have been taught to do. And in spite of the fact that those who are benefiting from the current situation of the world in neoliberalism and climate change disaster, those who are benefiting, these young people are not standing by and allowing this to continue. Who would have thought that it would be against the ruling opinion to be against genocide? These young people are finding out that they're supposed to be against genocide, and they're not surprised anymore, if they were, that the ruling class are coming down on them. I am particularly proud of the students from Morehouse, mm-hmm. Who mentioned in this article, but also there are students at Spelman who are protesting the genocide, standing up with Palestinians, and realizing, understanding that connection between Palestinian history and Black history, not only in terms of the common suffering, although of a different type in some way, in some instances, but the fact that those in the Palestinian movement have been supporters of Black liberation since the 1960s, the civil rights era, and we're seeing that time coming back in terms of protests and standing up for the ideals that these children have been taught.
Yes. Speaking of Black liberation, Black Agenda Report is U.S. imperialism moving toward, quote, humanitarian intervention in Burkina Faso. This is NETFA wrote this article. As Burkina Faso attempts to move away from neocolonial domination by France and the United States, the possibility of intervention via humanitarian channels grows more likely. And certainly humanitarian is set apart from the rest of the sentence. NETFA, you know, it seems to me that the U.S. empire, problems at home, isolated from its own people who are suffering economically and upset with foreign policy, yet trying to put out fires everywhere, one of them being in the Sahel region and certainly Burkina Faso, where their new leader has basically said, you know, and he asked the question, why are we going around the world begging people for things when we are so rich in resources? Once he asked that question, it was a question that had to be answered. NETFA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it also calls into question what they consider a fire, because some people will think, well, they might think the reference to the massacre, or the killing, or the reported killing of the people in those regions, the Soro and Nondin regions, was what this report, the Human Rights Watch report, was talking about. And that's what the article is about, is that how the Human Rights Watch reported this massacre, and the fact that the Burkina Faso, in turn, suspended for 2 weeks the media outlets BBC Africa and Voice of America, and I think that was how they reported on it. Because, and so one could think, well, there are fires like this, the humanitarian fires that they have to put out, like they had to put out the one in Libya to the point of destroying the whole country, because I guess, you know, but really the fire is what you mentioned. The fires are the projects or the efforts that countries like Burkina Faso, and then also in line with the alliance, along with the Alliance of Sahel states that it belongs to, Mali and Niger, as a representative of a Pan-African formation, that this is a fire for the collective West. This is a fire for the neo-colonizers of the United States and the NATO forces, for Africa to be embarking on a path of African unity and self-determination and decolonization. That's a fire. And so that what happens is you have outlets like the Human Rights Watch, which has its history going back to the 1978, the Cold War era, and was created for that, to cast all this propaganda against the Soviet Union. Now they've evolved and still playing the essential same role, where they do things like put out reports, you know, maybe in this instance again against governments that are in the crosshairs of imperialism. Those reports being the only and sole reference to a particular incident, as is here, and now it's being reported, you know, by these other or amplified by the media outlets, and then this picture is being painted. And this is often a prelude to why I said humanitarian intervention, something even more aggressive, where they will invade, you know. And so they can't accept, you know, the kicking out of AFRICOM, U.S. Africa Command, like Niger is trying to do, and others. And so they're being poised, they're creating the conditions if they have to take more decisive and progressive actions. Just the day after the article was published that I wrote, you have the U.S. or Reuters reporting a U.S. providing $55 million in humanitarian aid to Burkina Faso, being distributed through the U.S. Agency of International Development, USAID, the soft power, you know, before the jackals come in. And so that's, you know, that's how this is. So Samantha Powers was there doing it, and they're talking about these places in Burkina Faso that can't be reached right now with humanitarian aid, that are suffering. And they also reiterate the claim about this massacre. Now, I want to say something really quick before I end, is that one of the things Burkina Faso had is that they didn't like the accusation that they were doing nothing to investigate this. They denounced it as it's being reported as a campaign of terror against those civilians who are complicit with the Islamists. They're saying, no, we didn't, you know, we're looking into it, and we're not responsible as a you know, as the higher ups officially condoning this. So if some military officers did it, it wasn't something that was sanctioned by them. And as a sovereign country, they have the right to look into this for themselves and not be hamstringed or be subject to the reports, the unsubstantiated or any kind of reports by outsiders.
And, you know, Dr. Taheed, the we can't underestimate the economic impact on France in particular of losing these health region states that it was absolutely robbing blind. It would be difficult to believe that they will not act with you know, vengeance to try to reclaim those funds. Your thoughts?
Yes, France has been a particularly clumsy, if you will, and arrogant neo-colonizer. Particularly through its use of the CFA, once known as the Colonial Franc of Africa, the currency that the French imposed upon the Francophone countries in the Sahel, saying that you could only do your trading in these currencies, and that currency, the CFA, allows France to maintain its control over the economy of the Sahel. It allows it to exploit the labor and the resources of the Sahel and pay pretty much nothing for it because it has complete control over the value of that currency. And the fact that these countries are now throwing France out is one thing, but they're also going full steam ahead in getting rid of the CFA. To get rid of what is very much being called monetary imperialism, so that even if the French troops are gone, and they are, then as long as the Sahel countries, the Francophone countries, use the CFA, then the French presence is still there and colonialism is still there. And even among those countries in that region that are not Francophone, they have the organization, the ECOWAS, the Economic Council of West African States, Francophone and Anglophone countries, which were continuing on with the CFA after they created their monetary union. That time is gone, and they are looking for their own currency, their own sovereignty, to get away from the monetary imperialism from Britain and France and the U.S., and this is a way forward. It's going to be bumpy. It's not going to be an easy thing to do because there will be a Western opposition to this at every turn. But they are determined that they're going to go forward, and they're moving forward in the proper way.
And speaking of countries that are being economically mauled by France, the Orinoco Tribune reports traditional transitional presidential council takes charge in Haiti. So the transitional presidential council has been put together by by U.S. imperialism and Western imperialism, and now they've decided they're in power in Haiti. They have actually named the president. The Haitian people have a new president. The Haitian people have no input whatsoever, and we are back to another situation where the Haitian people have a government that has been foisted upon them. They have had no input in it whatsoever, and it looks that likely the resources of Haiti will be finding their way out of the country, shall we say. Your thoughts on the Transitional Presidential Council taking charge in Haiti, Net for Freeman?
Yeah, well, you know, it's interesting. I think it's almost hard to call what's been happening and persisting, the U.S. role in Haiti, to be even considered neocolonialism. It's more like direct colonization, and it's been that. The core group, which is, and then the putting together of this transitional presidential council didn't include any Haitian people, you know, at least not in person, and those who were there were just kind of observers on a Zoom call or something like that. So they're choosing these things. What's happening in Haiti, if we even follow the statutory logic of this, is that all the officials, you know, that were governing under the person I'm blanking on the name, Ariel Henry, mm-hmm. And all those, and the ones before that under Jovenel Moïse, because Jovenel Moïse extended his power past the mandate, and all this whole process is unconstitutional and is therefore illegitimate, and it's been used. And this whole crisis actually can even go trace back at least as far back as 1994 when they deposed Bertrand Aristide. So all of this is like, and the U.S. orchestrating this and trying to bring in troops to get in control, you know, and CARICOM authorizing it and playing along with this stuff. We just got finished talking about ECOWAS, but I think we should, Black Lives for Peace is having a webinar tomorrow on ECOWAS and CARICOM and the neo-colonial functions they play, because it is complicated. We need to look at this. But U.S. creates these crises. This is what they're par for the course. They create crises and they want to come in and be the benevolent resolvers of this crisis. And they're right now they're trying to, because the Haitian resistance that is steadfast, they're trying to make sure that never takes hold. So they have the reactionary forces being called gangs that they nurtured, or they, along with the elites, nurtured the creation of really what are paramilitary forces and the guns coming from the United States. And now there's this rogue sort of wild element that they want to put in control, and they act like it's the primary contradiction, and it's not. You know, the crisis in Haiti is in a crisis of imperialism, because they created it, and it's there to make sure they circumvent any civil society or people-centered process, democratic process.
You know, Dr. Tawhid, isn't it interesting that when we talk about the Sahel states, we see that France was involved, and basically France was just robbing them of their natural resources, you know, taking their, giving them a couple of bucks for their uranium and then selling that same uranium for $250-some on the market. And we look at Haiti, and here's France again, and France literally made Haiti pay them for like centuries for overthrowing the slave owners. It comes back to finances. Of course, Haiti has all kinds of natural resources that are finding their way into France and the U.S. and Canada. Your thoughts on the Haitian situation, Dr. Tawhid?
Yeah, it would be remarkable for all of this consternation to be over such a small, poor country like Haiti, except for the fact that a couple of things. One, Haiti is very close to Cuba. And right off the coast of Haiti, there's offshore oil and plenty of it. And if it were not for those things, the U.S. would not be interested in. Of course, Haiti, former colony of France, France was interested in it because it was its choke point, if you will, in the Caribbean during French colonization until the revolution that kicked Napoleon's army out. But Haiti is still very central in the Caribbean. And all the consternation over that very small and poor country is over its resources, particularly over the oil off of its shore and its proximity to Cuba.
And let's bring this all into one big, bring it all together in one bucket. Sheer Post. If Ukraine loses war, it will be the end of Western hegemony. That's according to former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. You know, it's interesting that he just comes out and he says, if Ukraine falls, it will be catastrophic for the West. It will be the end of Western hegemony. The thing about it is this. I don't think the people in the Sahel region will be crying themselves to sleep. I don't think the Haitians will be upset. Western hegemony has not worked for, let's start here. It hasn't worked for the people in the global South. And now it doesn't even work for the people in the West. The working people are suffering at the hands of Western hegemony. Your thoughts on that, folks?
Yeah, well, I mean, it hasn't worked for him because Western hegemony today is really a successor to colonization yesterday, direct colonization, and this is basically it. It is an order, you know, that is trying to hold on to, you know, like it says, to, you know, Western or in hegemony. It's interesting that Johnson say, well, we might say the quiet part out loud, but I don't even know if the West has been that quiet about it. They really have always talked about their, you know, their dominance and the need to hold on to that. But what's interesting, and he's just telling a truth, it's really, it shows why they're so desperate in so many places and why that desperation also results into things that are them committing acts that are almost counterintuitive to what they're really trying to achieve. We have most of the world not even participating with the sanctions that they have, and those that have are really, you know, they're really Russian, you know, they make up the not Russian, I meant to say the collective West, as we call it, or the global North, but the collective West. So it just shows where the line is drawn in the U.S. And I mean, we just got finished talking about why, and particularly what's happening in Palestine, exposes, takes the veil off, takes everything off, and then makes it even harder for the U.S. to claim that the actions they take are for the best interests of the rest of the world or whoever the targeted place is, the country in concern or whatever. It shows that their naked interests are really diabolical, and they're self-centered, and they're really about domination, and that is not even a domination where they would negotiate or, you know, try to, I mean, they strong arm. That's what they do. And that's what it comes from, the legacy of colonialism. So it's a gangsterist dominating by brute force type of thing. And so, you know, they undermining the talks and making sure that they can't exist. They have to thrive through war and destruction and domination. They can't coexist any other way.
Dr. Taheed, we got about 2 minutes. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say that Boris Johnson, of course, yes, is you know, saying the quiet parts out loud. But I would also say that Boris Johnson is a bit late. It's actually not the you know, if Ukraine goes down, it's not the end of Western hegemony. It's just the end of the beginning of the multipolar order. The beginning of multipolar
the end.
The Western hegemony has occurred quite a bit quite some decades ago. it was slow to know this because the West, when Boris Yeltsin, when the Soviet Union fell and Russia came into the arms of the West, it was expected that Russia would be completely exploited, turned into a Western neoliberal colony, and that over the last couple of decades, that plan has gone out the window. So this is not the end. That end has come quite some decades ago. It's just now apparent to the elites that they can't put this process back in their pocket. You know, Boris Johnson mentions that this hegemony since the last war. What war is he talking about? Well, he's talking about World War II. Not this Ukraine war. You know, that hegemony has been on the downslide since the end of World War II, one with the arrival of the Soviet Union, which went away for a minute, but is now back as a Russia. And Russia is not the old Soviet Union. It's a very different thing. And now we have that agreement, that tight strategic alliance between Russia and China. This will well pass the end of Western hegemony.
Yes, I agree. And I'd say this, you know, the final nail in the coffin of this U.S. empire and Western imperialism is when they can no longer provide enough from their pillaging around the world to bribe the working class in their own country. When the working class in their country, when they've gone around the world and they pillaged, and they run out of people to pillage, and now they turn inward and say, okay, well, we will treat the people at home in the same lawless and reckless way that we've been treating the people all over the world. That's when they have to deal with internal uprisings. Netpa Freeman is the host of Voices with Vision on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. Dr. Linwood Taheed is the Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming back.
On April 24, 2024, an article was published in Middle Eastern Eye entitled, quote, Washington has lost touch with reality. If it doesn't adapt, the world will pay, end quote, by Marco Carnelos, a former Italian ambassador to Iraq and Middle East Peace Process Coordinator Special Envoy for Syria for the Italian government. The article gives a critique of U.S. foreign policy stands, and it's worth reading, which is what we're going to do now. The article reads, in a failing quest to maintain its primacy, the U.S. has cast China, Russia, and Iran as global villains. The U.S. intelligence community recently released its annual threat assessment, which focuses on worldwide threats to the country's national security. The document reflects the collective analysis and insights of the Central Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, Federal Bureau of Investigation, and more than a dozen other agencies. The report's foreword provides a clear sense of this community's dystopian and self-referential thinking. Quote, during the next year, the United States faces an increasingly fragile global order, strained by accelerating strategic competition among major powers, more intense and unpredictable transnational challenges, and multiple regional conflicts with far-reaching implications, end quote. It continues, quote, an ambitious but anxious China, a confrontational Russia, some regional powers such as Iran, and more capable non-state actors are challenging long-standing rules of the international system as well as U.S. primacy within it, end quote. Iran, Russia, and China are thus the main villains for allegedly challenging long-standing rules of the international system. No surprises here. This has been a U.S. policy mantra for years. The problem, rather, is that it is not clear to which rules the report is referring. The customary international law enshrined in the UN Charter and UN Conventions, or the so-called U.S.-led rules-based world order. The main conceptual problem is that for the U.S. political establishment and its key Western allies, there is no distinction. But as is often the case, they are grossly mistaken. International law and the UN Charter are the pillars of the global order built after the Second World War, to which the U.S. provided an outstanding contribution. Conversely, the U.S.-led rules-based international system is a more recent evolution of American political thinking, a self-referential mindset twisted to the interest of Washington and its allies. This order is based on neoliberal ideology and imbued with double standards, of which the tragedy unfolding in Gaza is the latest and most visible example. Based on a series of assumptions, such as U.S. exceptionalism and the undisputed superiority of Western democracies, that is, Western civilization, this system claims national laws as universal ones. It assumes a set of values and connected rules, but is quite careful not to implement them when they collide with its own interests. This order can be summarized by an informal motto, quote, for my friends, everything. For my enemies, the law, end quote. Challenging U.S. hegemony. Unsurprisingly, the report from the U.S. intelligence community blames China, Russia, and Iran, along with a handful of non-state actors, including Hezbollah in Lebanon, Hamas in Palestine, and the Houthis in Yemen, for challenging not only the rules of the international system, but above all, U.S. primacy within it. It seems that the real crime is not challenging the system itself, but rather U.S. hegemony. Yet, while such a preposterous position could still have been accepted a few years ago, it is now openly challenged, or at least resented, by many countries across the so-called Global South. Only a minority of countries in Europe and East Asia consider U.S. primacy to be an essential prerequisite of a stable international system. In fact, scrutiny of the last two decades of history proves the opposite. The global order is shifting from a unipolar configuration centered on the U.S. to a multipolar one. Throughout history, empires have risen and then collapsed. U.S. policymakers would be wise to adjust to these rules of history and give up on the notion of their indispensability. They now face a binary choice: accept history's verdict, as the UK has progressively done since 1945, or catastrophically resisted. A reference to the Gaza crisis in the report is even more enlightening about the U.S. intelligence community's dystopian views. Quote, "One need only look at the Gaza crisis, triggered by a highly capable non-state terrorist group in Hamas, fueled in part by a regionally ambitious Iran and exacerbated by narratives encouraged by China and Russia to undermine the United States on the global stage, to see how a regional crisis can have widespread spillover effects and complicate international cooperation on other pressing issues," end quote. This passage suggests that the U.S. intelligence community is fundamentally incapable of seeing the conflict in Gaza for what it really is, a national liberation struggle triggered by decades of brutal and unpunished Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands, facilitated by massive U.S. weapons deliveries and a political shield at the U.N. Security Council, where the Israeli government would otherwise be held accountable for its war crimes. The U.S. narrative that the events of 7 October are also traceable to Chinese and Russian attempts to undermine Washington on the global stage borders on the ridiculous.
And Cornelis continues with double standards. The real factor undermining the global standing of the U.S. is not the alleged actions of certain autocracies, but mostly Washington's own international behavior and double standards, exemplified by its unwavering support for Israel's bloodbath in Gaza, an assault that violates all the rules that the U.S. has been preaching for decades. This is demonstrated perfectly by the Biden administration's behavior after the recent adoption of the UN Security Council resolution demanding a ceasefire in Gaza. After allowing the resolution to pass by abstaining, the U.S. rushed to minimize its meaning and impact by qualifying it as non-binding. So for the sake of clarity, the indispensable nation that prides itself as being the main enabler of the long-standing rules of the international system, the beacon on the hill, is essentially telling another UN member state, Israel, that it can ignore a Security Council resolution demanding an immediate ceasefire after more than 34,000 people have been killed in Gaza. The tragic irony is that the Netanyahu government did not even need this exhortation. It would have ignored the resolution anyway. For the record, UN Security Council resolutions are always binding. The Biden administration thus missed another excellent opportunity to distance itself from hypocritical double standards. It accomplished an outstanding masterpiece of upsetting everyone, Israel and the vast pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. for not casting its veto, and the left of the U.S. Democratic Party, the Palestinian people, and the rest of the world for outrageously calling the resolution non-binding. Meanwhile, the U.S. threat assessment attributes to China, quote, the capability to directly compete with the United States and U.S. allies and to alter the rules-based global order, end quote. It thus equates a simple Chinese capability into a deliberate intent pursued by its leadership, while indirectly confirming that in U.S. official thinking, the only world order that can be contemplated is one led by Washington. In a flash of common sense, the threat assessment acknowledges the U.S. actions intended to deter foreign aggression are often, quote, interpreted by adversaries as reinforcing their own perceptions that the United States is intending to contain or weaken them, and these misinterpretations can complicate escalation management and crisis communications, end quote. If the U.S. intelligence community's analysts have been surprisingly smart and honest in recognizing this problem, known by international relations experts as the concept of, quote, the indivisibility of security, end quote, i.e., any security measure taken by one nation can be interpreted as a threat by another, they should also be able to admit that their dependency to equate hypothetical capabilities with automatic intentions is a big part of the increased tension characterizing modern politics. That was a reading of the article, Washington Has Lost Touch with Reality. If it doesn't adapt, the world will pay, by Marco Cornelos.
That's it for today's show. The show included audio from The Critical Hour, hosted by Garland Nixon and Wilmer Leon. Thank you for listening. Remember to tune in to Voices with Vision every Tuesday from 9 to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and follow and like Voices with Vision on Facebook.
A heads up, Pankaj Asadi Shakur Study Group session, 7 p.m. tomorrow Wednesday, May 8th at the Black Workers and Wellness Center is on community safety and alternative solutions to the root causes of crime. If you make it, I'll see you there. Remember, next week will be our first show for the spring membership drive, so we'll be looking for you to support your Jazz and Justice station. Be sure to tell your family and friends and all of your social media networks to tune in so we can make light work of the goal required to sustain the station. You can follow me, Netfa, on Twitter. That's Net for Free. That's N-E-T-F-A, free. And don't forget, you can listen and subscribe to Voices with Vision as a podcast on iTunes or Player FM. Just search for Voices with Vision WPFW. Keep it locked right here for Crossroads with Rosa Brown and Nkezi Taifa. Make an effort to stay politically educated, organized, and committed to the fight for the liberation of your people. Or
fall back.
It goes F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people. F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your freedom. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your freedom. L-I-B-R-B-G, we live F-R-E-D-I-E. We lace music with cold, just something to bring us closer. Kick true, the young black youth like we're supposed to. No swine in our Rovers or Louis Vuitton holsters. We in the trench for young 50 cent and street soldiers. The ones they ain't lock up and send the foreign waters to fight for something they ain't got in their own borders. It's us, the free unit, they ain't holding us back. We just caught a soundtrack to this movement, y'all just rap. Brat, black on black and clap about that. State trooper shot, assemblies boy in the back. Miss Rogers, boy in the back. While we ain't firing back, the boys is gone and they ain't coming back. We gotta go back. San Kofa right and exact. It's the red, green, and the black, black, black. It go F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back if you ain't trying to ride for your people. Fall back if you ain't trying to die for your people. F-A-L-L-B-A-C-K. Fall back.
My Body, My Festival is a three-day, three-night abortion access music festival happening May 16th to the 18th. Presented by DC Abortion Fund and Burger Sounds, My Body, My Festival will take place at local venues across DC, including Pie Shop, Songbird, and Metro Bar. Featuring acclaimed local artists across genres, including Deborah Bond, Sneaks, Amy Bormet, Verge, Alex Hamburger, Akua Ulrich, and more. My Body, My Festival is a celebration of our city and abortion access in support of abortion seekers living in or traveling to the DC area. Tickets and more information can be found at mybodymyfestival.com. WPFW, Radio for the Resistance.
Inspired by Holly Near's Send In 1,000 Grandmothers, Raging Grannies and Code Pink are bringing grandmothers and those who love us to the U.S. Capitol Thursday and Friday, May 9th and 10th, to lobby and hold our legislators accountable. In order to nourish our courage, there will be a free concert Thursday night at 7 p.m. at the Washington City Church of the Brethren, 337 North Carolina Avenue Southeast, featuring Emma's Revolution, DC Labor Chorus, Songrise, Black Workers Center Chorus, Colleen Cattell, Annie Hassett, and of course the Raging Grannies. This song fest of peace and justice music will inspire and encourage us to keep on keeping on as we invoke the true purpose of Mother's Day to call for peace. All are welcome to join both days. For details, visit codepink.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Robin Holden.
Hi, this is Miyuki Williams.
WPFW programmers Miyuki Williams, Robin Holden, Craig Williams, Jim Byers, Verna Avery Brown, James Funk, Captain Fly, Tom Cole, Bill Wax, Kim Babe, Joni Eisenberg, Arthur McLeod, Donald Temple, Bill Starr, Lona Elias, Ron Pinchback, David Whetstone, DJ Abby, DJ Divine, and Willard Jenkins will celebrate you at Washington's premier jazz club, Tacoma Station, 6914 4th Street, Northwest Washington, D.C. This is a musical tribute on Sunday, May 26, from 5 until 9 p.m.
This event features internationally renowned bassist Michael Bowie, Hope Udobie on keyboards, Charles Wilson drums, Grace J and Sing Steph on vocals, and others.
Please come and join your favorite programmers for some great jazz, food, cocktails, and a little dancing for a Sunday jazz happy hour you will never forget.
The event happens at the Tacoma Station Jazz Club, 6914 4th Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., a musical fundraising tribute, Sunday, May 26, 5 until 9 p.m. The tickets are $50, and there are only 100 tickets for this VIP.